Welcome once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan. With me today is Stephen Gray. Stephen is a speaker, events planner, workshop leader, and author. His first book is titled Return to Sacred World, published by O Books, and he has a forthcoming title, published by Inner Traditions, with the provisional title of Cannabis and Spirituality, which is due to come out next year. He's been married to his wife, Diane, for almost 30 years. Stephen is also the founder of the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference in Vancouver, British Columbia, where I will be speaking next weekend. You can find a link to the conference website and instructions on getting tickets in the program notes to this podcast. Welcome, Stephen. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, hello there. Yes, I'm happy to do it.
So, Stephen, I'd like to talk a little bit about your background, and then we can discuss the conference. Well, let's start at the beginning of your journey. How did you get interested in plant medicines?
Sure. Good question. I'm 66 years old, so I'm from the baby boom generation, and I was very interested in the what we call the countercultural ideas of the late 60s and early 70s. And a big part of there were two things going on that were really interesting at the time to me, and they dovetailed for me and a lot of others, but not for everybody. One was interested in the psychedelics, particularly LSD was the most common at the time. And the other one was Asian spirituality. Although there was some Christian element that people were interested in as well, but people were very interested in Hinduism and Buddhism and Zen and things like that at the time. And as I say, for a number of us, the psychedelics, we were interested in the spiritual component of that, although I would certainly confess to doing them very poorly in terms of set and setting or setting at the time. But I was interested in the spiritual component of that, and I was also very interested in these Eastern spiritual teachings. And so to try to keep it sort of short, I probably did acid about 20, 25 times. Had some, you know, poor experiences and a couple of remarkable ones that kind of always stuck with me. But then there was a common theme at the time, relatively common amongst that bunch of people, which was, okay, the door's been opened, the window's been opened, you've looked in, now what? So for a lot of us, that became something like meditation practice. And for me, that led toward Tibetan Buddhism. And starting in the late 70s, I got quite involved with Tibetan Buddhism under the auspices of crazy wisdom master Chögyam Trungpa.
Sure.
And I was involved with that community, very, very involved for roughly 10 years and then gradually faded away in the 90s, in the 1990s. And nobody around there was, you know, in favor of the psychedelics at the time. So I left that behind. But a person we both know quite well, and not personally necessarily, but Terence McKenna, I give credit for bringing me back around again to the medicines. I always felt that they had that potential, but because of that, you know, being involved with the Buddhism, Sangha, etc., I left that behind. But McKenna hooked those two things back up for me when he said that there's thousands of years of history in indigenous communities of using these substances spiritually. It was a light went off, right? So you know, again, to try to keep it sort of short, one thing led to another. I started working with psilocybin a little bit on my own, and then I started to feel that I needed more help with more guidance, you know. And that eventually led me to get involved with the Native American Church, peyote-using people in Washington State. And I was fairly involved. I used to go like 4 or 5 times a year, drive down there, go to one of their meetings, went to a couple of Sundances as a supporter and all that. And that was really remarkable. And along in there, I also used ayahuasca occasionally in shamanic ceremonies of the Peruvian style or Amazonian style. And then I've worked with other substances here and there. The last year or so, I've gotten fallen in, as it were, with a group of Santo Daime people up here who I really like here in Vancouver. And I never thought I would. I'd read about them. I'd read Forest of Visions, and somehow this idea of the way they do things didn't really appeal to me. But I just got invited to come along one time, and I thought, oh, well, let's go find out, you know. But I like them. It turns out I quite like them, and I like the container that they create. So I've been working with them. I've been to about 10 of their ceremonies in the last year or so. So that kind of sums it up. And then in terms of the work and the conference and all that, the book that I wrote in 2010 or had published in 2010 was called Returning to Sacred World, and that connected me into a few people. And the short version of that is I got invited to help organize the Spirit Plant Medicine Conference, and I've been doing that ever since 2011 or 2012. So
Right on.
that's kind of brings you up to date with that.
Okay. It's interesting. It seems that the Santo Daime have a pretty good foothold in the Pacific Northwest. Are they?
It's a small group up here in Vancouver, but they're very passionate about what they're doing, and they're connected to one of the lineages, I guess you'd say, from Brazil, one of the major ones. They're the twice a year they bring up one of the main people from there. It's a husband and wife. The Padrinho is the honorific, but his name is Paulo Roberto, and his wife Nonata. They take turns coming up here. And when that happens, they get 60, 70 people, and they do two ceremonies, Saturday and Sunday. But then they do local ones as well, just with the small group, and they can only house about 20 to 25 for those. They do those about once a month or so. So it's a smallish group that's the committed core group up here. But as I say, they have these larger ones a couple of times a year as well.
And what is it that you find useful or powerful about the, let's just say, the container that they've built?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. This is just personal, of course. Not everyone would experience it the same way. Well, let me step just one sort of half step back to say that the reason that I didn't think I'd be interested was because it sounded a little too Christian to me. They do, I'd heard that they do Christian hymns, and they dress in white, and they sit up in chairs, and the lights are on, and they separate men and women. And it all sounded a little too conservative to me somehow. And somehow I kind of thought that, lying down in the dark and having the shaman sing Ikaros was the way to go. But because I was invited by the head of the local group here, and I liked him, he wasn't square at all, his hair halfway down his back sort of thing, I accepted the invitation when Nonata for one of the ones that Nonata came up for, and I loved it. I thought it was great. The hymns are actually beautiful. They're not your standard Christian hymns. They're about the medicines and the teachings. There is Christian references in there, but when you're in the middle of an ayahuasca experience, when you're deep into it, and Jesus's name comes up or Mother Mary's name comes up, it all just seems to fit. It's like, okay, you put any name you want on it. We're talking about the spirit here, right? I don't care what name you call it. And there's the reason for the white is just keep things really simple and is symbolic of purity and all that. Didn't bother me either. And there's a reason for separating the men and the women, and it actually has to do partly with the movement of energy. They sit in rows. The rows run from fore to aft in the room, and there's a central table where the main people sit and the teacher, and then the women sit in several rows on one side of that facing inward toward the middle, and then the men on the opposite side. So part of it, it's been explained to me, is the actual movement of energy. It goes around in a clockwise direction, and so it moves through the men's side and then across and through the women's side and back around again. And the other reason is just to keep it really simple for the women in particular, because as I'm sure you know, Jonathan, probably, I don't know, just a wild guess, 80 to 90% or more of women have had some kind of negative experience regarding sexuality. And so to be in a completely vulnerable place where you're just open, wide open to the spirit or whatever, just to have women sitting around them is comforting. Does that
Sure,
make sense?
it certainly does, yeah.
So I'm cool with that too. And so what this container created for me, was it simplified everything. So, like, you're lying in the dark and there's people around you puking, and some of them might be a little weird or acting up or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
It's usually me
it's
that's
not.
acting weird.
Beg your pardon?
I said it's usually me that's acting weird.
Oh, yeah. Well, we could tell stories about that kind of thing, I'm sure.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
And so, yeah, for me in those environments, I've done those about a dozen or so times over the years.
Yeah.
It's kind of like anything goes, and there are a lot of visions, but I didn't know what they meant most of the time. There could be really amazing, really beautiful, but as far as actual direct teaching, I was never really quite sure. Not never, but a lot of the time, I didn't really quite know what I'd gotten from the experience,
Sure.
Whereas in the Santo Daime ceremonies, it's really clear. It's just between you and spirit, and you know exactly where you are in terms of your surrender, your degree of surrender. That's
Interesting.
what I experience. You
Wow.
know, I see my mind try to get away from nowness, if you will, right? From surrender. I see fear come up. I see ways to try to distract myself. I see impatience or judgment about myself or the situation. And it's all right there. It's like, oh, that doesn't work. Let her go. Come back. Be present, oh, relax in the spirit. Oh my God, it's completely overwhelming. That's frightening. I want to run away from this. Nope, that don't work either. What I'm saying?
Yeah, sure.
So it's very, it, to me, for me personally, I can't speak for other people. That particular environment clarifies and simplifies the relationship between you and unconditional reality, if you want to call it that.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a really good insight. I appreciate that.
Okay.
So, as I was preparing for this, I was reading a few things that you'd written, and I was really hoping that you would share a story from your blog that I thought was really cool, in regards to a elder in the Native American church attending a was it a book signing of yours or a
Yeah, so
presentation?
that book I mentioned, yeah.
Yeah, and I thought this was a really interesting story, and I think that it really echoes to a lot of the lessons that that some of us have gained from these plant medicines in terms of especially like honoring our promises. And so I'd like you to share that because I think it's really powerful.
It is really powerful, I think. If you don't walk the talk, that and $2 will get you a cup of coffee, right? Although no one's perfect, and this particular elder by the name of with the I'll use the name Canukas, it was a spiritual name, I guess, wasn't perfect either. And you just have to ask his wife about that.
Right.
Who would know better, right? But the way he dealt with people in general, when he died, sometime later there was a memorial for him held on the Suquamish Reserve in Western Washington. 300 people showed up, and a lot of people didn't show up because they just couldn't make it, because he knew people from all over the western half of the United States. And every single one of those 300 people had received some kind of benefit from knowing Canukas. He had helped them in some way or another, either by his teaching or by just the kind of thing that this story is about. He had lots of other things going on in his life. He didn't need to help me like that, but the book had the last third of the book is kind of medicines 101. There's a chapter on several of them, and one of them is on peyote and the Native American church. At that time, I'd been involved with it for about 6, 7 years or so. And I was concerned about it because I'm writing about it because I'm not a native, and I wanted to be sure I was being respectful and also accurate. So I
Sure.
ran it by Canukas. And in fact, I sent him the whole manuscript, and he read it and he said he was good with it. He thought it was fine. And so I asked him if he would consider coming up to Vancouver to speak at a book launch for the book, and he said yes. So then what happened when it came, that was several months ahead, but then when it came time, he and his wife were working in California, harvesting medical cannabis, actually. And so I called about a week ahead of time on their cell phone, and his wife answered, and she said, "Oh, we're down in California." And Canukas is still planning to come up, no problem. So she said, "Check back in to make sure in a couple of days." And so I called again. I forget what it was, like 4 or 5 days before the Saturday of the event up here in Vancouver. And his wife answered again and said, "I don't think this is going to happen. He started to come, and actually, just for background there, he needed that money. He was down there for like a month to make money, and he took right out his time right in the middle of that to come all the way up to
Oh,
Vancouver,
that's awesome.
drive all the way up to Vancouver just to do this for me because he said he would, right?"
Wow.
So, but what happened was, so the next time I spoke with his wife, she said, "I don't think this is going to happen, Stephen. He and his daughter and grandchild started to drive up. They got up as far as Arcata. They hit some black ice at night driving. The truck rolled over 180 degrees, or maybe actually, I think it was 400 and something. Like it was a full 360 and another 180.
Jesus,
And
Pete.
upside down in a ditch, the truck was totaled. They weren't hurt badly at all. The other two were totally fine, as it turned out, just by luck. And Canukas did have some injuries. He cracked his collarbone and a bunch of other bruises and scratches. So that was the truck that they were going to come up in. They had another small vehicle down there, and I kept in touch over the next several days. His wife said that he still wanted to do it in spite of all that, but he didn't know how he was going to get there. So on the Thursday, they decided she drove him up to their home in Port Angeles. So then I talked to him on the Thursday, and he said, "Well, I still want to come, but I don't know how I'm going to get there. So I don't know if I'm going to make it or not." So then what happened was, the next time I talked to him on the Friday, he said, "Oh yeah, some guy just showed up out of the blue and said he can drive me up to the border, but he doesn't have a driver's license and he doesn't have a passport, so he can't cross the border. Can you come down and meet us at the border?" And that's almost a story in itself. But basically, I met him. The customs people didn't know what the hell to do with this. They just wanted to drop him off at the border, and they finally let that happen. And so I picked him up and drove him the 45 minutes up to Vancouver. And he stayed with me for the weekend, and he did this talk for me. He's sitting in my kitchen, and he showed me his collarbone, and pointing out the back of his shoulder bone,
Oh,
like it
my
was actually,
Lord.
yeah, that was the kind of, and he had bruises and cuts and bandages on him, and he drove all the way up from goddamn California to do this because he promised it. And not only is that an exemplary example of walking the talk, but it produced a commitment in me. I'm not sure I always live up for it, but it was a turning point in my life because I felt like I needed to be more generous with people in my time. Because basically, you ask him to do something, he'd do it. You say he'll do it, and he'll do it. He did it. So that to me is as powerful a teaching as anything you can get. You know, that the medicines, if you use them well, if you use them wisely, and if you take your, that was one of his teachings actually, was one of the things you'll learn from this medicine, he'd say, relatives, one of these things you'll learn from this medicine is to find out what your responsibilities are. And I asked him, how do you find that out? He says, "No, that's for you to find out. Nobody can tell you what your responsibilities are. You decide what they are, and then you live them. You act on them." And that's to me why his teachings were valid, and the medicine work with the peyote medicine and the Native American church ceremonies were valid, because that's the way he was with hundreds of people in his life. You want him to do something, he'll get in the car and do it. Even if he did, oh yeah, usually he didn't have any money. Like somebody in California would call him up and say, can you come down and run a meeting for us? My relative just died, or my relative's got cancer down here. And he'd say, sure. And, he'd maybe have enough money to get down there, enough gas money to get there, but not to get back, you know? So people would have to take up a collection or something like that, you know? They
Yeah.
didn't pay, he didn't pay any attention to that stuff. It's like, needs to be done, bam.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that I talk about a lot when I get when I give talks and I emphasize a lot in my podcasts is the idea that it's really important for people in the medicine communities to build real community, not just, chatting with people online, or, watching videos or even going to conferences, but like making real connections with people and, doing things together outside of the ceremony space, so that, like, the people that you drink ayahuasca with, you also have cookouts with, and you also help each other move, and you also take turns babysitting so that people can have a date with their partner, or like, being like building real community interaction. And I think that's a just a really great example of living that value. That's an awesome story.
Yeah, thank you. It is. And I really appreciate what you just said too, because that is an important part of the work. And maybe we can in the next few minutes even lead back to the conference on that one.
Sure.
But it's been people have undertaken that work to some degree up here as well. There's a group called Jubilant People. It's mostly women that started this when they saw a need for integration. You know, they could see people going to these ayahuasca ceremonies, coming in having perhaps a remarkable experience, a powerful opening experience, and then boom, you're kicked out back onto the street again into a culture that doesn't have a clue what what
Right.
happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think the it's a big part of the work, because I'm sure, as you know, Jonathan, mostly these medicines, until we quote unquote Westerners got a hold of them, most of them were done in the context of a community,
Right.
like a physical, localized community, right?
Right. Yeah.
So you weren't away from it in between time. You know, you were around the same people from Monday to Saturday, and you do the medicine ceremony on Saturday night or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, we haven't had that. So we, you know, we're in a kind of a revolutionary time where we have to build this structure from the ground up.
Yeah.
And a huge part of it is creating communities. So that's part of what the conference is about. You know, you
Yeah.
say you can just go to a conference, but one of the reasons for coming to a conference like ours is to meet other people that are doing the same thing.
Right.
And so I'm actually the MC at the conference, and one of the things I say to people at the beginning is, please put yourself out. You know, even if you're a shy person, walk up to some complete stranger and say, hi, I'm so and so. How did you get involved in this kind of work?
Yeah.
And yeah.
One of the things that I always loved that Terrence McKenna would say, like I would, listen to his talks on tapes and stuff, and he'd always say that, the really important thing for you being here is not coming and listening to me talk, but it's talk is meeting each other and, finding the others. That was the finding the others is so important. And I still think that's that, I've been to five different conferences on the East Coast since 2012, and they're getting to be now like family reunions. There's just these people that I'm really tight with, and I'm very, very excited to be coming out to Vancouver because there's a number of people that I've interacted with virtually on Skype and on the internet, and I'm very much looking forward to getting to meet those people face to face. So very excited about
Yeah, well, good. And
it.
as long as we're talking about that now, since you've already just said that, why don't you? I was going to go through and talk a bit about some of the themes and the major presenters. And why don't you just speak for yourself about maybe a little teaser about what you're going to talk about?
Sure. So my talk is going to be about reclaiming family values and religious freedom, and highlighting how the sort of political, social definition of family values as defined by sort of mainstream conservative culture, and sort of juxtaposing that with a set of values we have at psychedelicparenting.org called the five psychedelic family values, and showing how these five psychedelic family values can kind of be a new way forward for society, and is kind of in some ways the medicine that our culture, our material culture, really needs now. And then talking about the word religion and how it has kind of gotten a bad rap among liberals and forward-thinking people because they kind of constantly associate it with kind of all the negative things that come with religion. So people lots of times will say, you know, I'm spiritual but not religious. And what I like to emphasizes that, well, even especially in the United States, that, you know, we have freedom of religion, but we don't have freedom of spirituality. So when we say I'm spiritual but I'm not religious, in some ways we're like giving away our rights. And what we need to do is sort of let go of the negative baggage of the word religion and recognize that what we're doing when we consume plant medicines and we interact with that unity and touch that sort of deepest part of ourselves, that this is like the core of actual religious experience. And that if we can build community out of that experience and develop our own traditions, that, you know, we can sort of challenge this idea of like what really is religion and what does religion look like and what does community and family look like. And so that's sort of a teaser for what I'm going to be talking about.
Yeah, that's great. Well, as I said earlier, you know, we're in this kind of transition period where we're you know, the culture or cultures of people who are interested in this work are building new structures, and so it's a very exciting time with a lot of potential. You know, you never know. I mean, history's long, hopefully. What can happen in the future? But I just hope, you know, for the time being anyway, people get this right. You know, I'd like to think that there is a consciousness revolution or transformation revolution going on the planet, and what it at on some core level is a move toward individual empowerment, and individuals trusting their own awakened intelligence, so that we don't need the safety, as it were, of such almost rigid kind of structures. You know, when you talk about the word religion, most people that have trouble with it, it's because it's not the word religion in itself, it's the religious institutions. You know, the danger always in any organization, no matter what kind, is of things becoming frozen, as it were, you know. Developing a dogma, and, you know, oh yeah, well, the teacher said that, so it must be true, sort of thing, you know. We had a pre-conference event a couple of nights ago with Yalila Espinosa, locally here, and she had a lot of interesting things to say, but one of them was, it seems like the age of the guru is over. And that's actually one of the teachings of the Santo Daime people as well, is that, you know, they have this little kind of aphorism or whatever you call it. I guess it's almost like a Zen quiz or something. Who is the wisest of them all? Wiser than all the Buddhas, wiser than all the teachers, wiser than God, you know, whatever. Maybe not God, but, and of course, the answer is you. Nobody knows what you need to do and can do it other than you. So you are the teacher, you know. My old Buddhist teacher, Chögyam Trungpa, used to say that at some point the phenomenal world becomes the guru, right? You just pay attention and you're learning all the time, and you have to trust your own intelligence, your own native intelligence. So that's the transition, I think, that's going on now. So I hope we get that one right, and you know, are always on guard for the potential of things sort of getting frozen into some kind of an institutional structure that becomes hidebound in some way, right? Yeah. So that's what we're trying to do at the conference, is move this work forward. In intelligent, respectful, responsible, sustainable ways, and every level, a humble ambition, no doubt.
Yeah, I like too that I was listening to you and Martin talk the other day about the converts, and I very much like that you have this emphasis on the divine feminine, because I think that that's for me in my own medicine ceremonies, the spirit always approaches me as a feminine spirit, and it's always like this, it's either like a lover or a comforting mother. And so we want to talk a little bit about more about that and like who's going to be speaking on those topics.
Yeah, so interesting that you said that last little bit about the lover, because we just interviewed Annie Oak on Andrew Resmer's radio show on consciousliving.org. It's up on the podcast archives, by the way. Also, we did two others of with presenters, Marguerite Reguilloso, who's coming to the conference, and Bruce Damer, who's coming to the conference. They're all fascinating interviews. And one of the things that Annie said was, what if we didn't think of, or we didn't speak of Earth as our mother, but as our lover? So the whole thing with the sacred feminine, divine feminine, whatever you want to call it, I've been calling it the rise or return of the sacred feminine, is that we've become drastically out of balance, and the sort of archetypal qualities or whatever you call them of the sacred feminine have been suppressed, repressed, and ignored and disrespected for, in many places for several thousand years now. And for us to move forward in a healthy, sustainable way as a species, we need to bring those qualities back. We need to get back into balance again between the yin and the yang. We've been very yangy, and it's been a problem because well, I refer to it as the male ego, but if you think of it as a disease almost, it infects everybody. So it's, women are also susceptible to that, quote, what I might call the male ego as well, which is the sense of what Buddhist teachings would call the illusion of a separate self, right? That you're disconnected from life, from the cosmos, from the earth, from each other. That rebalancing of bringing the sacred feminine back into all affairs is essential. So that's actually though that and another theme in the conference is another theme that's almost the same theme is where we're going as a species. And several people are addressing that directly. But without the rebalancing of the return of the sacred feminine, then that ain't going to happen. That is not going to happen. So there's a feminizing influence that needs to happen, I think, right? Feminizing, maybe people don't, everyone has their own ideas. The way I describe that really briefly as it comes off the top of my head is learning to soften. And not that does not mean being weak. That's a problem that a lot of people have, a lot of men have. They think, oh, if you let yourself be more vulnerable, if you soften up, it's weak, and someone's going to beat the shit out of you or whatever, right? Robert Bly, in one of his books, said, every man knows in his sort of gut or in the cellular level that the guy he's standing in front of could beat the crap out of him, right? So that ancient cellular fear or, whatever that is. But, Chögyam Trungpa, again, using him as a reference, had a phrase that had to do with the meditation practice, was soft open front and firm back. So softening the armor is not becoming weaker. It's actually becoming stronger because it's not conditional. It's not based on me, building up my fortress and my troops and so on, right? It's being able to step out into the world without that kind of protection and be firm in my center, right? But it so the strength of what you might call the male strength and the female openness or softness or surrender dovetail and dance and make love together beautifully. But we, again, have become way out of balance, and that's why the return of the sacred feminine is so important. Feminine is so important to our trajectory as a species right now, And so going into, so Marguerite Rigoloso, her talk's titled Tales of a Reincarnated Delphic Oracle. And that's going to be fantastic.
Interesting.
I've talked to her twice on Skype. She's amazing. She's a mystic. She's a channel, a psychic, and a scholar at the same time with a PhD. And she sees herself as connected to that ancient lineage from ancient Greece, the Aurora tradition. And it's been suppressed ever since, essentially, but it's coming back now. And that's what she's doing and we're doing, is trying to bring that back more, right? Annie Oak is an amazing person. She's a culture influencer. She founded the Women's Visionary Congress, which has events up and down the coast here. I don't know if it's made it over to your side of the continent.
I think they're actually the first East Coast Women's Visionary Congress is, if I'm not mistaken, will be in March in New York City.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. And she's got a few other things rolling, something called the Full Circle Tea House, which was an oasis that she created, and has now spread to a variety of festivals, particularly ones where these medicines are taken, where Burning Man, where people aren't paying a lot of attention to setting, and they're kind of wandering around in the heat and the dust. They might be dehydrated and so on. And so she saw a need for creating an oasis, a safe place for people to go, called the Full Circle Tea House.
Yeah, she also, I spent some time there last year.
Great. She also has co-authored a psychedelic manual, psychedelic support manual.
Oh, great.
And she's going to be talking about, which also very much has to do with this return of the sort of women's understanding and so on. She's going to be talking, her title is called Rekindling Our Relationship with Traditional European Spirit Plants. And, of course, it was the women primarily who were working with those spirit plants. So bringing that back in again. So then the other sort of side of this, maybe the rebalancing that requires bringing back the sacred feminine much more strongly, is sort of what you might call the number one component almost of an even larger vision, which is just overall consciousness transformation in, you know, for the species. So where we're going with that, you know, what's happening to us right now and where we're going with that. Bruce Damer is amazing on that topic. And that's essentially what he's going to be speaking about. I think his topic is, his title is called Illumina, the Return of the Light. He also, in our interview with him, referred to it as the return of magic. He's a wonderful guy. He's a very brilliant guy. He's also a brilliant scientist who is, his personal company has supplied 3D modeling software programs and stuff like that for NASA. But he works with, in this sort of other side of his life, so to speak, works very deeply with ayahuasca and claims to have had conversations with what he calls the madre, which is, he says, the kind of the representative voice accessed through the ayahuasca representing Mother Earth, representing Pachamama. And he said it's an actual conversation because she doesn't know everything about us and what the monkeys are up to. So he's telling her what we're doing, and then she's saying, you know, what she sees from her side and what she can tell us about the planet itself, right? So he's really interested in this consciousness transformation journey that we're on, and he's a wonderfully optimistic guy as well. But he does also, you know, he doesn't dwell on the negative, so to speak, or the dire possibilities. But he does say that, you know, we perhaps, in fact, this is what he says the madre told him, is that we perhaps have until about the middle of the century for there to be quite a significant shift in our attitudes about who we are, you know, on this planet and our relationship to each other and everything. Or, as she said to him, she might be left alone for a while regrowing her trees.
Wow. That's definitely rings true with the kinds of insights that I've gained from my own medicine work too. It just sometimes seems like we really are running out of time to start making dramatic changes.
Yeah, I'd like to say that if anyone's listening to this and just doesn't like hearing that, I'd like to say, please, let that one go, because we got to face that reality, that possibility, I mean. And people just don't want to hear it because it just sounds so dark. Some people, a lot of people, don't want to hear about it. They, they don't want to hear about climate change. They don't want to think that, we're going down, that kind of thing. And I don't blame anyone for feeling that way. But it's part of the journey. The spiritual awakening journey is to, if you feel that fear about that, is to look at it and allow it to dissolve, and keep your eyes on the prize, as it were. As Bishop Desmond Tutu once said, the problem with a lot of people is they don't believe in the possibility of possibility. It's like, and the Native Americans and others would say, keep your mind on the prayer. You have a prayer, you have an intention. The intention is healing individually and collectively and planetary, and you don't dwell on the other possibility. You prepare for it if you need to, but you don't go, it's hopeless, because all you're doing is you're creating a state of mind of hopelessness when you do that,
Sure,
right?
sure. Yeah, we gotta keep working together no matter what, yeah.
We have to, Buddhists call it mind protection. We have to look after our own minds. So you have to be aware moment by moment, what's your state of mind? Are you feeling discouraged? Well, that's just your state of mind. That's not a reality, so we have to work with our state of mind that way.
Sure, yeah, that's great. I'd like to ask you a couple other questions. Number one, I really I just like looking at the parts of your book that I was able to read today. I feel like you have a really interesting perspective on sort of where we are as a nation, as a continent in terms of spirituality. And you have your relationship with the Santo Daime and with the Native American Church. And one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot recently, and maybe you can give some insight on what you think where we're going with this, is what do you think if we as sort of European descended North American people, I feel like we need to develop our own traditions, as it were, or like our own religion, if you want to say that, our own medicine practices. And I'm wondering if you think that's also the case, and what you think, say a, you know, what of a North American white medicine practice should or would look like.
Yeah, good question. And not a simple solution, I'm sure. But I do have ideas about that. Let's see. A whole bunch of things come up, honestly. One of them is, a thought that comes up is the same roadman from the Native American Church, Kanukas. He and some others too would say this, is stay behind the medicine. Don't get in front of that medicine,
Don't get in
right?
front.
You understand what that means? It means don't come from your ego and your big thinking things about all this, because you can actually tune in to a level of intelligence and wisdom and communication that's far vaster than that. So you stay behind the medicine, you stay behind the teaching, so to speak. You stay behind God, and you don't step in front of that.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's happening. I talk to a lot of different people that are coming into this work, and they say, oh well, I've been getting this message from the ayahuasca spirit. She's saying, focus in this direction on your work. So if you have an intention, that's the starting point, of course, right? Have an intention. What do you want to do? You want to help build structures, communities, whatever. Then stay behind the medicine. Stay
Yeah.
behind God, or whatever you want to call it, right? And let go and let God, or let the the wisdom of enlightenment, as it were, actually guide you intuitively.
Yeah.
And relax, and then, you know, just trust that. You know, for me, trust is a massive word. It's a capital T word. That, you know, in fact, you know, Trungpa, again, his Buddhist teaching was that the awakening journey is a gradual, generally, transformation from only trusting your own concepts and beliefs and, you know, all the stuff that's in your known up till now, gradually changing your allegiance, was his word, learning to trust and change your allegiance from that to the awakened state. Because the awakened state will guide you all the time, will guide you perfectly. It's impeccable in a sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
We just need to learn to trust that. So in terms of creating our own religions, as it were, mm-hmm. I think if people can keep that in mind and in practice, then it'll be all fine. Problem with Westerners, not to blame us over, you know, anybody else in particular, but with these quote-unquote moderns, you know, is of North America anyway, and probably, you know, European as well, and many of the modern cultures, but certainly I know from hanging around the planet for a while that I've seen this over and over again in North America, that there's this kind of attitude of, like, you know a little bit about something, and then you start setting yourself up as somebody who knows a lot about something.
Certainly, right? Yes.
Yeah, and that is a problem,
mm-hmm.
and has often been a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Who was it that said recently, somebody said, it's not what you don't know that's the problem, it's what you, it wasn't recent. I think it was somebody like Mark Twain or somebody. It's not what you don't know that's the problem, it's what you think you know that ain't so.
I have a friend who is an archaeology professor, and I attribute this quote to her. She says she doesn't remember saying it, but I think she did say it. She was talking about giving a lecture in one of her classes, and talking about kind of this attitude that she encountered a lot among people who were taking archaeology as an elective and who weren't really interested in, like, rethinking their religious or social constructs that they had built up. And she said to them, you know, having a strong opinion is not the same thing as knowing something.
No. Referring to Bruce Damer again,
mm-hmm.
He said, I think he said this to me on the phone, but I've also listened to a couple of his talks on his website. He has a wonderful website, by the way, called levityzone.org, levityzone.org.
Mm-hmm.
He's collected a bunch of his public talks on there. So anyway, I think it was in this phone conversation where he's telling me, you know, I told you earlier on that he had this ongoing dialogue with the Madre.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point she said to him, you silly monkeys, stop trying to figure it out. If you want to know something, become it. In other words, dissolve the boundary between you and other and enter it. You know, just like it's like an artist. Like, you know, if I don't know if you've paid much attention to the process that fiction writers talk about, but they talk about entering into that space. It comes alive. It's like they literally enter the world, the character.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I think I remember reading an essay of Tolkien's where he said that it wasn't so much, that writing about Middle Earth wasn't so much that he felt like he was creating it as he was, like, peering into the world and just simply like documenting what was happening.
Mm-hmm. And I've read interviews with writers that say they a character kind of naturally, you know, comes to them intuitively, and then they start writing that person's life, and they don't even pay attention to the plot because it unfolds for itself. But they literally, emotionally, physically, go through what that person's going through. You know, they go through the actual emotions that the person experiences, right? So, you know, that's kind of, this is going to be one of the things that comes up in Bruce Damer's talk, and kind of implied as a theme is that what we're doing is, I'll interrupt myself and say that Kalindi Iyi, who I don't know. He was at the conference in Ashland. I don't know if you were able to catch any of that after the fact or anything, but
No, I was not, but Kalindi and I are friends, and we know we're both from Michigan, and unfortunately we don't get to see each other in Michigan very often, but we do end up at a lot of the same events, and I think he's a
okay. So
brilliant
yeah,
individual.
no. So he's at the conference. He's doing two talks, actually, an hour and another half hour one right near the end. And his main talk is called Psilocybin Tool of Consciousness Exploration. And he's kind of got these amazing, almost frightening ideas about massive heroic doses that make Terence's prescription of ho heroic dose at 5 dried grams sound like a tea party, you know, and not an ayahuasca tea party either. But his second talk, the shorter one, is called The Mushroom and Our Transhuman Future. And I think, I don't know what that means. I'm really looking forward to seeing and hearing that at the conference. But my take on part of that is that we're potentially, our potential for our sort of evolution in the short term, like in the near future, is to recognize that we are not separate from all that is, and be able to enter into different kinds of realms and come back out again, so to speak, right? It's sometimes been referred to as the ability to be multidimensional, you know, to move within different dimensions. So that's a really exciting kind of idea as well. Yeah. So just to finish up just a little on your question about, you know, or maybe I've said it all, I don't know, but or all I need to say or can say about your question about, you know, where we're going in terms of creating structures in North America ways and so on. I think there's another little element to that, what I said about staying behind the medicine. That's the key. That's the number one thing, as I understand it. And the other another element of that is learning from existing traditions, because, you know, one thing, you know, in this kind of I've done it once and I know something attitude is you know, like I mentioned this thing, the problem is people who think they know things that ain't so. Well, people have no idea what they don't know. For example, the Native American Church and those ceremonies are really excellent containers, and they're very powerful and they're very effective. You know, most people have no idea if they haven't been to something like that or been into similar circumstances, what actually is going on there. You know, that there's a connection to spirit, there's prayer happening that can actually have real impacts on the material world and that kind of thing. You know, these people get it, you know, oftentimes, you know, these traditions, you know, they're not perfect, obviously, and they've got their own problems oftentimes too. But sometimes when there's a tradition of working with them, certain kinds of medicines, they know things that we need to learn from, we in the modern world. And then what we can do, as long as we're, as again, staying behind the medicine as we do it, and, you know, not getting too cocky about what we think we know, and, you know, there's reasons for things, right? Like you look, for example, in the Native American church, they have a water drum that they use to accompany the songs, the prayer songs that go on all night. There's a whole whack of symbolism around those drums, and it was taught to them, I've been told, by the elders, by the spirits. You know, that there's a reason for that drum being the way it is, and tying it up the way you do, and things that you do with it, you know. And then they say that when I've been told by drummers that when it's really happening, they can actually see spirit energy going out from the drum and around to the people in the teepee, right?
Oh, that's beautiful.
But if you just pick up a drum and start thinking, oh, okay, you know, I can keep a beat, you know, I know how to drum, you know, then you're missing this huge and powerful element to it. You know what I'm saying? So we need to be very open to learning from other people. It's almost akin as if, like, you want to become a violin player, you know. There's lots of different ways to do it, of course, but if you really want to become good, you go learn from somebody who really knows what they're doing, right? And you maybe study the traditional ways of playing and the traditional theory and all that stuff. And then when you know it, Chögyam Trungpa was like this too. He was raised in Eastern Tibet to be the supreme abbot of a group of seven monasteries in Eastern Tibet from the age of 3 until 19, at
Wow.
which time he and all the other lamas had to escape because of the invasion of the Chinese.
Yeah.
He was never afraid to innovate. He borrowed ideas for his shrine from Zen tradition and other places. He was never afraid to innovate, but it always came from a thorough grounding in knowing what he was doing from the tradition that he grew up in. So if you study a violin and, you know, you learn the scales and you learn the bowing technique and you get to the where you can, you've mastered all that, then you can do anything you want because it's coming from the right place and coming from an understanding, right?
Yeah.
So go ahead and create what Ralph Metzner called hybrid rituals, you know, but stay behind the medicine.
Yeah. There's a talk that I actually use fairly heavily in my own presentation that was given by Bob Jesse at the MAPS conference in 2013 in San Francisco. And he, it's called From the Johns Hopkins Psilocybin Studies to the Future of Religion. And I don't know if you've seen this particular talk, but it speaks very...
Yeah, I saw that talk, I think.
Yeah, it speaks very heavily to what you're talking about staying behind the medicine, because one of the things that he emphasizes is that sort of, that a, like, sort of post-dogmatic religion will have at its core a ritual which either points back to, reminds one of, or actually contains the mystic experience or the sacred medicine, and then by that function the religion is consistently renewed and refreshed, and the possibility of sinking into cult of personality or dogma or like empty legalism is weakened or possibly eliminated, because you can constantly, everyone has access to that experience, so you can constantly go back and kind of like check in with God, so to speak, and make sure you're on the right path. So I think that's kind of the same thing you're saying by when you're talking about getting behind the medicine.
That's the only way to do it. You know, it's
yeah.
like you call it the church of nowness or something, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's this balance between respecting what others before you have learned and keeping it alive so that it doesn't become frozen, so to speak, right?
Right.
That's the problem, and that's the problem. That problem has come about because of, you know, disempowerment.
Yeah.
That's why I said earlier that it's about re-empowering ourselves, so that, you know, who is wiser than all the Buddhas, right?
Mm.
You are.
Mm.
So you know, that's in my optimistic brain, so to speak. To me, that's what is happening on the planet. I don't know how fast it's happening. I think it needs to happen at a great rate and spread widely for us to have a decent future on this planet in the near term of the next few hundred years anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like I was saying about Chögyam Trungpa, knowing where you come from, knowing what, you know, what the reasons for things, like, you know, you want to go and change the way the drumming is done in your ceremony. Know why you're changing it. Know what you're changing it from, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know that they did that for a reason.
Sure.
You know? And if you don't know that, if you don't understand that reason, then you don't know what you're losing by changing it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that kind of balance between respecting tradition and not getting stuck in empty ritualism, or, you know, if you understand why and it makes sense and you're tapping into that sort of ancient wisdom, then that's the way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. Always being present, I guess you could say, so that, you know, like you can feel it out, you know, if that's what staying behind the medicine means, is like, well, maybe this isn't working so well, you know,
mm-hmm.
let's, you know, we know why we were doing it. We know what's working, what isn't, and let's try this,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. So I do want to ask you,
let's try this.
Yeah.
Period. Then you can create all kinds of weakening and watering things down, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Go ahead.
So before we run out of time, I did want to ask you one other question, and that when we were kind of talking before this conversation, we were talking a little bit about what do you feel like your role is in your family, and you were kind of talking about the concept of like the wider family or the wider psychedelic community and the roles that we play in those communities. And one of the things you mentioned is that you said now that you're 66 years old, you find that you're taking on this like elder role. And I'm interested in what you think what that means, because I think that one of the things that is really important and one of the reasons why I started psychedelicparenting.org is because I think that it felt like, even though we have, I think I kind of think of us as like in some ways like in the fourth generation of the psychedelic movement. You have like you kind of start out with Hoffman and Huxley, and then you get into Leary, and then McKenna, and then here. But it kind of felt like, even though there was like some level of like people passing things on, to some degree, like every single time people are sort of starting out from scratch a little bit. And we were like people, I was lucky enough as an undergraduate to kind of discover the teachings of Terence McKenna, but there was nobody like present physically to like teach me about these things. And one of the things that I think is really powerful about, say, like the ayahuasca movement now, or like the Native American church, for example, is that you have this like living tradition of like guidance and like being led through a ceremony and being shown the way. And I think that having a sort of elders can be important. And like you said, we're in this post the sort of post guru era. So what do you think is the role of the elder as opposed to the guru, for example, or the a sort of cult of personality? How do you see yourself falling into that role of elder?
Well, sure. I haven't given it a lot of words in my mind to think about that. It's just that I've seen myself fall, like where people are asking me things more, I guess, is part of it, right? So maybe it has something to do with just the fact that I've been around the block a bunch of times, and you start to put things together in certain ways, and you have experience, you just have experience that other people haven't yet had, maybe, right? So, it's similar to what I was saying about if you want to learn how to play the violin, well, you go to, if you really want to get good at it, go to a violin master, when you reach a certain age, if you've kept yourself alive, is if as Bob Dylan said, you've been busy being born and not busy dying, then maybe you learn a few things. And also, I don't know, I don't want to get too much into trying to put words on this one because I haven't before actually, but it's something about I mean, I've heard other people say it, I guess too, is that you reach a certain age where, I mean, at 66, I have my, I didn't have a family, but if, I mean, I didn't have children, but if you did have children, they'd be grown by now, and they'd be well into adulthood, probably. They might be 40 years old now, right? So you've gone through a lot of that part of your life. I used to teach elementary school music for about 20 years, actually. And, so I've been through that time of my life, of working more. I mean, I'm still pretty busy, but it's more, just stuff I want to do now. I have the freedom to follow my passions more so than I did in at that time. And, I'm not, at 66, I'm not going to be, I mean, there's still lots of things I can learn, obviously, but I'm not going to be starting up something that has had no precedent in my life before, right? I'm going to be developing the things that are already there. So you've got this sort of, you're able to, I think the journey of elderhood, so to speak, or just being older, has something to do with gradually moving away from certain levels of intensive involvement with the world, right? A former governor general of Canada named Jean Vanier was also a philosopher. And when he was 80 years old, he was interviewed on the radio, CBC up here one time, and he said, "At this stage of my life, I consider myself growing." But, and he didn't say this, glibly or with a sense of humor. He didn't mean it that way. But I'm growing down in a sense. Like I had a lot of responsibilities earlier. I'm not doing as much of that anymore. Now I'm sort of learning my own personal process is learning how to gradually shift into a different stage of life where I'm not as involved at the same level in the same way. I'm not in the thick of it.
Yeah.
But that gives you perspective too, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you also have perspective and you can see people. So there's some similarities between, I wouldn't put myself in the guru camp at all, but some similarities between being, you know, maybe you could say developing a bit of wisdom as an elder and being a teacher, I guess you could say, more than a guru.
Mm-hmm.
You're just pointing, really, hopefully you're just pointing people back at themselves.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, what is that person ready to learn? I mean, a young woman who came to, I organize Iboga ceremonies for mm-hmm. a couple of shamans from England. And we had one here a couple of weeks ago, and a woman, 32-year-old or something, that was at the ceremony, called me up or emailed me a few days ago, wanted to get together for coffee. And so we just did that this morning. And basically, it was just like, okay, she'd tell me sort of where she's at, and I you know, say things that might be useful to her to fit into her journey, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like that, you know.
Yeah.
It's like people see you, if you do have a little bit of genuineness, authenticity, a little bit of wisdom maybe, you know, then some, you know, younger people sometimes come to you for that. And also
yeah.
it's about, in my particular role, it's also about connecting people to different things too, which is not necessarily an elder thing per se, but it's like, okay, you know, people come, they know that I'm involved with this kind of work and they want to make connections
yeah.
in it,
mm-hmm.
you know, help them out with that sometimes as well.
Yeah. I found, I was, just this past weekend, I was at the Horizons Conference in New York City. And, so I spoke on Sunday and then I went to an after party. And it was interesting. I also found myself a little bit in that kind of elder place. I mean, I'm, you know, in my late 30s, and there's all these people mm-hmm. that are like early 20s there at this party, and people are asking me questions, you know, from a place of mm-hmm. like wanting information from you. And, you know, I'm just now getting into that place where I'm like, you know, I've spent my many years of sort of absorbing information, absorbing knowledge, and now suddenly now people are asking me to sort of, you know, sort of send it back out again. And it's very humbling to some degree. You're like, wow, this is a lot of responsibility to some degree. And it's funny because a lot of, you know, I talk about parenting, but a lot of the people that I interact with, we do these conferences at universities and stuff, and they're kids in their early 20s or their, you know, very late teens. And what they end up saying to me is like, I don't have kids, but tell me how to talk to my parents about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
that's become like this new spin on what my wife and I are doing, is how do you as a person in your 20s sort of come out to your family in an effective way? And that's sort
yeah,
of what we've been working
great.
On.
Yeah, good. That's good work, Jonathan. I really appreciate that you're doing that. I just wanted to, another thought occurred to me on this elder thing, is that I think, at least in my case, I feel like it's about starting to give back more too, right? You know,
yes.
As you get older in life, you know,
mm-hmm.
So much has been given to me. I've received so much from so many different aspects of life and from so many people that have helped me and taught me and,
mm-hmm.
You know, through books and through personal contact and everything, you know, my family, my dad, whatever, you know, all of it, the blessings that I've had in my life and the teachings I've received. And so I feel some responsibility to, in a sense, give back too. You know,
yeah.
I've still got a long way to go, you know, in terms of being a completely awakened person. Maybe that'll happen 10 lifetimes from now, you know, but so I'm still working. I'm still doing, you know, ceremonies, you know, like I said, with the Santo Daime and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And with cannabis in a spiritual kind of a way as well. But I also feel like I kind of, on some level, been there, done that. Like when I was 30, you know, I took almost all the money I had and went to a 3-month residential Buddhist seminary, you know. I wouldn't do that now, you know. But I did that at age 30. And,
yeah.
you know, so when you're in your 20s and your 30s, like, you know, you're hungry, right? Lean and hungry, as they say.
Yeah.
You know? And so I'm not lean and hungry anymore in that sense. You know, I'm not what's the word? I've forgotten the word. Overly comfortable about it. Complacent. I'm not complacent, but I've been through a lot of that. So there's some perspective that you have too, you know. And you've been, and also in my personal case, this would be different for every person, of course. I've seen part of my sort of naturally self-assigned task, as it were, to because of them, the medicines, is to inform myself about various medicines as much as possible. So I've explored psilocybin to some degree. I've worked with ayahuasca. I've had experiences with LSD. I've worked a little bit with MDMA, cannabis, you know, peyote, all these things. So I've naturally sort of seen a lot of different ways of doing this, and so there's a certain amount of compiling that goes on, right? It's just a version of elderhood, I guess you could say. Yeah.
Wow. This has been a really wonderful conversation, Stephen. I really appreciate you getting together with me. And just so we can recap, why don't you give our listeners the where they can get tickets to Spirit Plant Medicine Conference and location and times.
Yeah, well, it's in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, weekend of October 24th and 25th at the University of British Columbia. Tickets can be purchased on the conference website, which is spiritplantmedicine.com. Spiritplantmedicine.com. You can also phone 604-644-4447. Yeah.
All right, so once again, this has been the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. Thank you so much, Stephen Gray, and we will see you next weekend.
Thank you, Jonathan. I really look forward to this important w hearing more about this important work you're doing when you come to the conference.
Awesome. It's going to be great to meet you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye.